God is always faithful to his people. We had a delightful time last week in Sunday school as Diana gave each of us a test to help discover our motivational giftings. We're all so different, individually unique, and yet we need to come together to be complete in the body of Christ. Some to teach, some to exhort, to give, to serve, to organize, and to show mercy. Reminds me of a personal story by Max Lucado when he met a Barnabas one morning. Quote, "I jogged through my neighborhood the other day under a cloud, not a cloud of rain, but a cloud of self-doubt. The challenges of life seemed to outnumber the resources, and I questioned my ability, and quite frankly, I questioned God's wisdom. Are you sure I'm the right man for this job?" was the theme of my prayer. Apparently, God really wanted me to give me an answer, because I heard from on high, from a deep, booming voice, "You're doing a good job." I stopped dead in my Reeboks and looked up, and seeing nothing in the clouds, I shifted my attention to the roof of a house. And there he waved at me, a painter dressed in white and leaning against a dormer, and I waved back. And I wondered and almost asked, "How did you know I really needed to hear that? Did I have a brush with an angel? Or did I meet an angel with a brush? Was the worker sunstruck?" Well, this much I know. A painter spots a middle-aged guy with a bald spot puffing through the streets and thinks, "This guy could use a good word," and so he gives it. "You're doing a good job." Am I stretching theology a bit when I suggest that God put that man there, at least in part, for me? Long before time was time, God saw each moment in time, including that one. He saw a minister in need of a word. He saw a fellow with a skill for painting and a heart for encouragement. He put one on the street and one on the roof so that the second could encourage the first. Multiply that tiny event by billions, and behold the way God sustains the world. God, who makes everything work together, will work in you into his most excellent harmonies. Philippians 4:9. What causes you to feel anxious or fearful or discouraged? Remember that God faithfully loves you, faithfully cares for you, faithfully provides for you. God is faithful in everything. So celebrate. In our study series, we have come to the chapter 9 of the book of Esther. And I've been really enjoying looking into Esther and Mordecai and Haman and Xerxes. And in fact, after we get through next Sunday, which will be chapter 10 of Esther, I hope to start a series which I'm going to simply call Cast of Characters. And each Sunday we'll look at a different character of the Old Testament or New Testament and see if we, common people who have been touched by an uncommon God. In this chapter 9 of Esther, Vine's expository Bible, we also see reason for celebration. Two significant activities resulted from the king's new decrees, fighting and feasting. Both of the royal decrees went into effect on the 13th day of the 12th month. The Jews fought their enemies. They killed 75,000, including the 10 sons of Haman, whose bodies were hung. The Jews didn't touch the spoil of the enemies because they were not interested in the plunder. And then the Jews stopped fighting and began to feast, verse 17. Mordecai understood the significance of what the Lord had done, so he and Esther took steps to establish what would become the annual Feast of Purim. Purim is a reference to the pur, P-U-R, the dice or lots that Haman used to pick the day in which the Jews were supposed to be annihilated. The Jewish people to this day still celebrate the Feast of Purim as a reminder of what God did for them during the days of Esther and Mordecai. There's a big bug in the center of Enterprise, Alabama. It sits on the statue of a Greek woman. She has white marble arms that extend high above her head, somewhat like the Statue of Liberty. But unlike her famous counterpart, the Alabama lady doesn't hold a torch. She holds a bug. Well, strictly speaking, she holds a bowl, and on the bowl is a boll weevil. The insect weighs 50 pounds and is celebrated by a nearby plaque. It says, in profound appreciation of the boll weevil and what it has done as the herald of prosperity. The statue was erected in 1919, and the bug was added 30 years later. Who does this? Why make a big deal out of an ugly weevil? Since its arrival from Mexico in 1892, the pest has cost the cotton industry more than $23 billion. The insects does to cotton fields what teenagers do to pizza, gone in a gobble. And by the 1920s, boll weevils were having their way with the Alabama crops. They would not and could not be eradicated. So why honor them with a statue? Well, the answer to that question involves a seed seller by the name of H.M. Sessions. He saw what was happening to the crash crop and knew he needed to act. And in 1916, on a trip through Virginia and North Carolina, Sessions saw peanut fields. And he learned that peanuts were impervious to the boll weevil. So he came home with peanut seeds and sold them to C.W. Baston. Baston planted them and made $8,000 from his new crop. He paid off his debt and he had money left over. Word spread quickly, so farmers jumped on the peanut bus and rode it straight to the bank. And according to Smithsonian Magazine, by 1919, when the boll weevil scourge was wreaking its worst havoc, Coffee County, Alabama, was the largest producer of peanuts in the nation. So Max Lucado suggests, let's talk about your boll weevils, shall we? Cotton-chewing varmints have swarmed into your world. Unwelcome pests, are they not? Toll-taking scoundrels, how dare they feast on your harvest? And now the barns are empty and there are questions aplenty. What do I do? Where do I turn? Let me add one more question to your list. Might the bugs actually be a blessing? The boll weevil took much for sure, but had there been no bug, there would have been no peanut harvest. Or in your case, no struggle means no strength, no mountain means no mountain peak, no setback means no comeback, and a comeback is yours for the taking. Yes, boll weevils sometimes make us better. And that's the anthem of the story of Esther. The Jewish people who were once joyful inhabitants of Israel, they were scattered like dry leaves in a winter wind. They had no temple, no homeland, no leader. Where was the Joshua of the day, or the David or Elisha? Nowhere to be found. The Jews were leaderless minnows in a sea. That was Persia. And Persia? Well, as you know, the king was a louse and his chief of staff was a thug, and the two Jews were of prominence, Mordecai and Esther, had chosen to keep their nationality a secret. So it wasn't the best of times for God's covenant people. But then Mordecai and Esther planted some peanuts. He took a stand. She took a risk. Haman died on his own gallows. The Jews took up arms and defeated the Persians. The day of their scheduled defeat became the day of certain victory. Xerxes issued a decree causing Haman's plot to boomerang, and he and his sons were hanged on the gallows. Esther 9:25. And Esther 10:3, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellows, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. V-Day celebrations everywhere. A new chapter was written in the history of the Jewish people. They realized that they could embrace their identity, even in exile, that they could trust the hidden hand of God. There wasn't any need anymore to hide their nationality. A person of faith could be a person of influence. Mordecai, the man at the gate, became Mordecai, the Jew in the court. Esther, the quiet king, became Esther, the Jewish heroine. The entire nation experienced a refounding of Jewish people on an entirely different basis. It was a revival of sorts, a renewal. To ensure that the Jews would remember this moment, Mordecai and Esther commissioned an annual commemoration. Chapter 9, beginning at verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the time when Jews got relief from their enemies, and the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the book of Esther doesn't end with victory in battle. It ends with a call to remember. And just as Christians read the story of the birth of Christ at Christmas, so the Jews read the story of Esther during the Feast of Purim. The holiday is to be commemorated after the scheduled day of execution, a reminder that the day has come and gone, and the Jews are still standing. Purim holidays are really quite a rowdy affair, like sort of like Halloween parties or masquerade parties. There's an abundance of food and drink and costumes. And as the story is read, the audience reacts and Haman's name prompts loud boos and hisses and shouts. The idea is to muffle the very sound of his appearance. I found an interesting thing by Mike Casper. Writing, he describes it this way: in a controversial passage of the Talmud, Jews are instructed to drink wine on Purim until they can't tell the difference between the phrases "cursed is Haman" and "blessed is Mordecai." This practice is not recommended for the church. A more reasonable tradition would be baking of the Haman Tashen, a three-cornered jelly-filled pastry. The hidden jelly recalls the hiddenness of God. I like that tradition. Jelly is sweet and tasty, and when hidden in a donut like you get down at Alpine Bakery, it's a real treat, a surprise to discover. And I like the idea that God's presence, scrumptious and unseen, is baked into the story of redemption. And I appreciate the value of a two-day celebration in which people of faith revisit the day and the way that God prevailed. We tend to forget. We tend to forget that God is for us, not against us. That God is with us, not away from us, that God is busy, not sleepy. We tend to forget that God can make beauty out of ashes, joy out of mourning, an army of out of the valley of dry bones, rejoicing out of sorrow. We need memorials that jog our memory. Kathy DeGaine in Bridges for Peace tells of one of the most profound observances of Purim that included no wine, no pastries. There was none to be had. The celebrants were barely alive. The congregation consisted of 80 men crammed into a half-buried hut. Their bodies were racked by typhus and dysentery. Their clothing hung like rags from their frail bodies. They subsisted on a daily portion of bread and soup. They had no hope, no solution. They were prisoners of Auschwitz. J.J. Cohen was among them. He was a teenager then, living in a Polish ghetto when he was taken to a death camp. He survived the Holocaust, and he remembered back to the day the prisoners remembered Purim. They took a little fragment of potato and a piece of bread, and they passed it, each person, one to another, in order to fulfill the tradition of giving gifts of food to one another. And it fell to young Cohen to read the story of Esther. Quote, "When I read aloud about Haman's downfall, the spark of hope deep inside every Jew's heart ignited into a flaming torch. When I finished, everyone cheered. For a brief instant, the dreadful reality of the death camp was forgotten, and all hunger and suffering had receded. Having exerted all my remaining energy into my reading of the story, I sat breathless, but with my spirit soaring, and like a river overflowing its banks, the festive atmosphere and the vision of redemption burst out of broken hearts of the camp inmates." Try to envision those men, those skeletal men. Incline an ear into this moment to hear their cheer, anemic yet triumphant. And I wonder what kind of story can do that. What sort of narrative has the power to lift the spirits of dead men walking? Do we need such a story today? Well, we sure have one. Satan's scheme to kill the Son of God was defeated on the cross designed for Christ. Don't you know the devil wanted to puke when he realized that the cross, a tool of death, had become an instrument for life? So that we would never forget that moment, Jesus gave us our own celebration, the Lord's Supper that we just experienced. Reading from Luke 22, verse 19, "On the eve of his crucifixion, Jesus took some bread, gave thanks, broke it, gave it to the apostles, saying, 'This is my body, which I am giving for you. Do this to remember me.' In the same way, after supper, Jesus took the cup and he said, 'This cup is the new agreement that God makes with his people. This agreement begins with my blood, which is poured out for you.'" Words that are precious to us as Christians. They might have been curious to the apostles. A broken body, spilled blood. Can good come from this? And for you and me, from in our broken world or our leaky faith or our fragile dreams, can good come from this? Esther says yes. Easter says yes. Purim says yes. Communion says yes. This is the promise of God. It simply falls to you and I to receive it. Receive the cup, receive the bread, receive the pastry with its hidden sweetness. Don't be done in by bad news. Don't despair over Ukraine and the world's mess. Don't fall victim to the voices of panic and chaos. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. You have a good God who has a good plan, and that plan is revealed in his good book. I heard earlier this week, we can learn more about what's really happening from the Bible than from CNN. Today's confusion and crisis will be tomorrow's conquest. Take God at his word. We can reframe the way we see this winter and season. We can recast the struggle for what it is, an opportunity for God to do again what he does best. Flip a story on its head. Resurrect life out of death. I close with a devotional that I read this week. It was based on Acts 2:24, but God raised him from the dead. God's sovereignty bids us to fight the onslaught of fret with a sword that is etched with the words, but God. The company is downsizing, but God is still sovereign. The cancer is back, but God occupies the throne. I was an anxious, troubled soul, but God has given me new courage. The ultimate proof of providence is the death of Christ on the cross. No deed was more evil. Yet God not only knew of the crucifixion, he ordained it. Everyone thought the life of Jesus was over, but God. His son was dead and buried, but God raised him from the dead. God took the crucifixion of Friday and turned it into the celebration of Sunday. So let's celebrate our risen, our reigning Lord. Selah.